Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
3.5%. That's how fast the GDP grew last quarter. A nice, healthy number. Does raise two questions, though. What the heck is GDP anyway? And how real is that 3.5%? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. American Public Media presents Early Lessons, an American Radio Works documentary supported by the University of Virginia's Batten Institute. More at AmericanRadioWorks.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 29th of October, and it is good to have you here. It's also good to be able to say this. The economy grew last quarter. It has been a year since that's been true. 3.5% was the increase in gross domestic product, as I said. You know, GDP is one of those indicators where if you ask somebody if they know what it means, they'll say, yeah, sure, it's all the goods and services produced in a given economy. But then, if you ask them what it really means, that's a tougher question. Here with the answer is none other than our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
C plus I plus G plus X minus M. That's what you see in a textbook.
I know, it sounds complicated, but Ken Mayland of Clearview Economics says it's actually pretty simple. C, that's all we consume or buy. Plus I, that's investment by businesses in everything from software to a new plant. Plus G, all government spending, federal, state, and local. Plus X, our net exports, whatever U.S. businesses sold abroad. Minus M, what we imported. Mayland says the GDP can also be measured at the other end by totaling all the money Americans took in. Either should provide a sum equal to the GDP number.
If you take up all the incomes earned in the economy, all the wages plus all the interest and dividend incomes and rents and profits and so on, that should add up to GDP.
Keep in mind, though, a relatively slight shift in spending can look impressive when it comes to GDP growth. Joel Neroff is chief economist for TD Bank.
Housing construction added a lot to growth in the summer quarter. If you talk to a developer, they wouldn't say they're building an awful lot of homes, but now they're actually building some rather than reducing their construction activity. So the change in the level is what mattered, not the actual level itself.
So why does everybody pay so much attention to the GDP? I asked David Smith, a professor of economics at Pepperdine University.
Just like Robinson Crusoe, we can only eat what we produce. So it's a direct measure of our well-being as an economy.
Smith says it's the figure that tells us the most about our standard of living. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
All right, now that you know the hows and the whys of gross domestic product, maybe we ought to look at the what fors of today's report, the ABCs of it, if you will. Imagine for me in your mind a graph, a chart of the progress of the American economy. The big question now is what letter shape the line on that chart is going to resemble, because the best way to understand economics, of course, is to keep it simple. David Weiss is the chief economist at Standard & Poor's.
I don't think it's going to be a W-shaped recession. That doesn't mean you're going to keep up 3.5% growth, though. I think growth is going to revert to more 1.5% to 2% after this quarter.
That is no double-dip recession, Weiss says. There will be some ups and downs, but the trend will overall be positive, even when you take into account the huge amounts of government spending that helped nudge today's number up above 3%.
Half the growth in the third quarter came from cars.
That'd be cash for clunkers, great economically while it lasted, but that's not going to be in the numbers next time around. It looks like the homebuyer tax credit might be. And I asked David Weiss about money from the stimulus package, all the billions in infrastructure projects and the like that has yet to be spent.
I think we'll start seeing more of them in the fourth quarter, but the problem is you're going into the winter, and you don't do a lot of highway construction during the winter in the northern U.S.
No, you don't. There is something else to think about, too, as recovery starts to become more real. All the money the government has borrowed to save the banks and keep the economy afloat. Even though the numbers are so big, it seems like play money sometimes. Economist Ked Goldstein at the Conference Board says the debts are very real.
You don't need a PhD in economics to figure out that somebody's going to have to pay that money back, and that somebody's the American taxpayer. Not now, but once the economy does finally get back on its feet, you know, the American taxpayer, you and me, are going to get hit with a bill to pay for all this.
To some degree, recessions are all about how we feel about them. Consumer confidence is still down in the dumps someplace. And even if this recession is not truly W-shaped, Goldstein is worried that consumers might think it is.
If the economy slows down either in the fourth or first quarter to, let's say, 1% or even less than 1%, it's going to be so slow out there that it's still going to feel like we're back into recession.
And that's for the people who have jobs. Remember, the unemployment rate traditionally tells us where the economy has been, not where it's going. Tim Quinlan is an economist at Wells Fargo.
We'll probably see employers start adding to payroll sometime in the second half of 2010, but that won't translate into a drop in the unemployment rate until very late in next year. So between now and then, the headlines will still talk about rising unemployment, regardless of how the consumer is spending, and even if businesses pick up spending, ultimately the job market needs to recover in order for any kind of lasting recovery to form.
So all of that said, once you get past the deficit and the unemployment and what letter this recovery may or may not look like, what does today's report really mean? The best thing we heard on that all day was this from economist Margaret Sims at the Urban Institute.
Well, I think that we have to say it means something, but it doesn't mean that things will get better right away. It's a sign of hope, you might say, not a sign that your reality is going to change in the short term.
3.5% growth is great on the face of it. Better, in fact, than the historical average for the American economy. But as we all know, there is nothing average at all about the 2009 version of that economy. Healthcare is a big and growing chunk of the American economy. Today, Speaker Nancy Pelosi unveiled the House of Representatives' plan to do something about that. 2,000 pages covering everything from pre-existing conditions to a public option. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Today, we are about to deliver on the promise of making affordable, quality health care available for all Americans, laying the foundation for a brighter future for generations.
Like the bill being developed in the Senate, the House health care overhaul would create a government-run health care insurance program that would compete against private insurers. Both bills are likely to dramatically expand Medicaid. The House version extends that benefit to working poor families from coast to coast. And both bills would require most Americans to begin buying health insurance by 2013 or pay penalties. But as the president pointed out to small business executives today,
if you are happy with the insurance plan that you have right now, if the cost you're paying and the benefits you're getting are what you want them to be, then you can keep offering that same plan. Nobody will make you change it.
The final version of the Senate's health care overhaul hasn't been hammered out yet, but there will be some differences. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has said states should be allowed to opt out of the government's insurance plan if they want to. And the House and Senate also have very different ideas about how to pay for all of this.
They're coming from very philosophically different places.
Karen Davenport's at the Center for American Progress.
I think it's the biggest difference. I think it's also probably the hardest difference to work out in the end.
The Senate wants to pay for the overhaul by taxing high-cost health plans. The idea is that would change patients' behavior. But Davenport says that proposal's not very popular with unions, whose members would pay the price. So the House has proposed paying for its bill with a new tax on families that make more than $1 million a year. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Why, yes, that was a 200-point gain on the Dow you saw today. Amazing what a growing economy can do. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner took a trip up to Capitol Hill today for yet more congressional testimony. New regulations for the financial sector were on the agenda, specifically a plan to give regulators hefty new powers to take over large financial institutions that run into trouble and to take them apart if they have to. The secretary got the same treatment from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle this morning. Rough. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The bill gives a council of regulators the power to seize and sell off the assets of a broad range of financial institutions deemed too big to fail. If the takeover creates losses, regulators would slap fees on other big financial firms. The idea is to shield taxpayers. Even traditional Democratic supporters of the administration criticized the bill, like California's Brad Sherman.
This is the most unprecedented transfer of power to the executive branch to make decisions about both spending and taxes in history, all without congressional approval, and a sharp departure from our constitutional values.
Secretary Geithner said the proposal is based on the authority the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation already has to tap an insurance fund to cover bankruptcies of smaller banks. Over the questioning of Republican committee member Spencer Baucus, Geithner insisted he's not asking for too much government power.
Without the ability for the government to step in and manage the failure of a large firm and contain the risk of the fire spreading, well, we will be consigned to repeat the experience of last fall. It's a really stark, simple thing.
And FDIC Chairman Sheila Bair said the assessments on large financial institutions would hold investors and managers accountable.
The primary benefit of that is that the strong signal it sends to the market, these are the rules. You will take losses if you fund or invest in high-risk-taking institutions. Forget too big to fail. These institutions are going to be closed and you will take losses.
Financial Services Committee Chairman Barney Frank said he'll bring the proposal up for a committee vote next week. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
What John Dimsdale was just telling us about, the government's new plan to take over institutions that are too big to fail, is known as resolution authority, being able to resolve a crisis, I guess, before it gets out of hand and puts taxpayers on the hook. Commentator David Skeel says government's new plan sounds a whole lot like the old one.
No more bailouts. That's the new mantra in speeches by the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, and the Treasury. Next time a financial behemoth stumbles, they say, taxpayers won't be footing the bill. But will this new proposal to give government more power to take over and dismantle firms really end bailouts as we know them? Not likely. Sure, it has a few new bells and whistles, such as a requirement that large financial institutions prepare a so-called living will. That would be each firm's emergency plan in case of catastrophe. And big financial institutions would need to pay fees to protect against the costs of a future failure, just like commercial banks already do with deposit insurance. The fees are the clever new innovation. Bank regulators now promise that the financial institutions themselves, not taxpayers, will bear the costs of cleaning up any future Lehman or AIG. This makes a nice soundbite, no more taxpayer-funded bailouts. But it doesn't take into account the possibility that regulators will pour taxpayer money into an ailing behemoth in some other way, or the likelihood that big finance will simply pass on the costs of the new fees to consumers. But the biggest problem is that rescues will continue to be the strategy of choice when a financial behemoth fails. We've learned all too well that institutions that expect a helping hand if they stumble may take egregious risks. And the winners in the rescues always seem to be other big Wall Street firms, whose loans and contracts with the failing firm are protected. Rather than expanding the bailout policies of the past year, Congress should think about ways to encourage these institutions to file for bankruptcy, like other companies do. If a bank regulator comes to your door chanting, "No more bailouts," don't believe him. They may look a little different, but bailouts are what he's selling.
David Skeel is a professor of corporate law at the University of Pennsylvania. If you've got a comment for us, visit our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, could it be the divine right to use fossil fuels?
The good Lord put more coal in the ground in America than any other country in the world, and we need to treat it as an asset, just as it is on any company's balance sheet.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials jumped 199 points today, 2%, closed at 9,962. The NASDAQ put on 37 points, 1.8%, finished at 2,097. The S&P 500 gained 23 points, 2.25%, ended the day at 1,066. Excitement over today's GDP figure pushed many stocks higher. Financials led the way. Citigroup banked a 5.6% gain. Bank of America jumped 4.8%. Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo, all three of them shot up around 4%. Bank of America jumped about 4.8%, as I said. Almost all of the Dow's 30 companies gained today. Consumer products companies were big winners. Procter & Gamble was up 4%. Colgate-Palmolive squeezed out a 1.6% gain today. Alcoa proved its mettle with a nearly 9% increase. Caterpillar scooped up 5%. Motorola and Office Depot both put on more than 9% today as well. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.5%. 3.5% is another way to say that, I guess. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. And by SunGard, $25 trillion of investment assets are accounted for with software from SunGard Financial Systems. More information at SunGard.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Friday. The Commerce Department releases the September report on personal income and spending. It's the second night of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's 25th anniversary concerts. Performers include U2, Metallica, and Aretha Franklin. And events begin for the final Formula One race of the season. This year's culminating race will take place on a new track in Abu Dhabi. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Much as it has on the international level, the domestic debate over what to do about global warming came to a political fork in the road today. The Senate Environment Committee, as we've mentioned, is discussing that chamber's climate change bill. They are in their third day of hearings, but they may not get much further. Today, Republicans on the panel said they are considering boycotting more meetings. They want an analysis of the costs of the bill from the Environmental Protection Agency, and the head of that agency says that analysis could take a month. By then, it'll almost be time for Copenhagen. A big UN meeting on global warming is set for early December in the Danish capital. Hopes are fading for a comprehensive agreement at that meeting, but like it or not, there are economic, political, and human problems that come with living on a warmer planet. That is the backdrop for our series, The Climate Race, that we've been running this week. Today, sustainability reporter Sam Eaton and Sarah Gardner explain what it's going to take to break us of our greenhouse gas habit. And Sarah, it doesn't sound like that's going to be easy.
Well, that's right, Kai. In fact, this is the part where you start to get a little overwhelmed, because scientists are telling us in order to escape the worst effects of global warming, it's going to take a huge transformation in how we make power. Some say the world needs to convert around 80% of the energy we now get from fossil fuels to cleaner alternatives.
Right, and the scale of this is daunting. One engineer actually did the math, and he found that getting to even a quarter of that goal would require installing a wind turbine every 5 minutes for the next 25 years.
And that's pretty hard to imagine. But at the same time, many scientists and engineers are telling us this is doable. We already have the technical know-how. We just basically need a World War II-style mobilization to make it happen.
But instead of tanks and artillery shells, this time it means retooling factories to churn out those wind turbines I mentioned, and also components for nuclear power plants, solar panels.
Yeah, and some big investors are already buying into the idea. Google, for example, is putting money into a solar thermal plant about an hour's drive north of Los Angeles.
Right now, we're between the two fields. This is field one to our right.
So, Sam, this solar plant is run by a startup company called eSolar. Now, this is not solar panels on rooftops. This is acres and acres of mirrors focusing the sun's energy to make steam. It's pretty elementary technology, actually. I mean, the Chinese supposedly were using mirrors back in 700 BC to ignite firewood.
But instead of firewood, you're heating up water.
Or oil or molten salt. Different companies are trying out different things. eSolar's using water. One of eSolar's executives, Dale Rogers, showed me around.
For this particular site, we have almost 24,000 mirrors. We have two full fields, two towers, two receivers.
So, Sam, imagine this. You've got row upon row of solar mirrors out in the desert, and they're all reflecting the sun's rays onto a 200-foot tower. The top of that tower is filled with water. Think of it like a big solar boiler. You can see this thing a mile away. It's so bright. Now, the water in that boiler is heated by all that energy reflecting off those mirrors. It gets to over 800 degrees Fahrenheit. The steam created then drives a standard steam generator that makes electricity. Here's Rogers again.
Our goal is to be competitive with natural gas type systems in the near term. In the longer term, we'd like to be competitive with coal.
In fact, some advocates of solar thermal say we could power pretty much the entire United States if we fill an area in the Southwest, an area about the size of New Jersey, with these mirrors and receiver towers. We have the know-how to do that today.
Right, but technology is only half the battle. The stuff costs a lot of money, and you need the political will to drive that kind of transformation. I spent some time in coal country in the hills of West Virginia, and I can tell you that for many people there, energy isn't just about technology, it's a way of life. Here, listen to Bill Rainey. He's the president of the state's Coal Association.
The good Lord put more coal in the ground in America than any other country in the world. And we need to treat it as an asset, just as it is on any company's balance sheet.
So, Sam, I can only imagine that in a place like West Virginia, all this talk of a green energy revolution falls a little flat.
To say the least. But there's a growing number of people who want to move away from coal. Judy Bonds is one of them. She's a coal miner's daughter. Her family's lived in the same valley for 10 generations. But she's become an outspoken advocate for wind power. And that doesn't always go over well in the middle of coal country. Here she is.
We have been called un-American. We have been called communist. I personally have been attacked. And there are threats of attacks because of the fact that we want to bring in wind farms. And the coal industry considers that a threat to their bottom line, to their reign.
Now, Bonds heads a citizens action group called Coal River Mountain Watch. They're fighting to stop a coal mine slated for one of the last untouched mountains in the area. They want to put hundreds of wind turbines on top of the mountain. And this is the reason I went to West Virginia, because the battle they're waging over the future of this one mountain shows just how hard it is to compete against an entrenched industry like coal. Here's Rainey again.
We make bituminous coal here, and we make electricity. And we send that electricity to D.C. and to Chicago and to Atlanta and all over the Midwest and the East. And our people are very proud of what they do.
Problem is, all that coal Rainey is talking about is also the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions here in the U.S. Another advocate of wind, Lorella Scarborough, told me the future of Coal River Mountain, either as a wind farm or a coal mine, represents the larger choice we face as a nation.
One is clean energy that will last forever, and the other is dirty energy that is finite and will someday run out.
So I have to ask, Sam, who's winning the fight? I mean, does wind even have a chance here?
Well, actually, the potential for tapping wind power on some of these ridges is tremendous. But coal, by far, is our cheapest form of energy today. Although a lot of people would argue that the only reason that price is so low is because none of the external costs are accounted for.
External costs meaning the carbon dioxide that comes from burning coal.
Right. And those are costs that some in the coal industry don't acknowledge. Here's Don Blankenship. He's the CEO of Massey Energy, one of the largest coal companies in the world. And it's got the permits to mine Coal River Mountain. We talked in his office near the Kentucky border.
There is no global warming. We went through the population fear. We went through the killer bee fear. It's just the next phase. It'll go away.
And if it doesn't, and if legislation passes and coal emissions are taxed and regulated, what then?
Teach your children to speak Chinese. Because if we're going to play around with windmills and solar panels, we'll fall behind.
It doesn't sound like he's a big fan of renewable energy.
Not exactly. And he's even against capturing and storing carbon emissions underground. That's the technology that could essentially keep his industry in business if carbon is regulated in this country. Blankenship says it makes American coal producers uncompetitive. And he says without coal, West Virginia's economy wouldn't exist. And he does have a point. In many parts of the state, it's pretty much the only game in town. But Judy Bonds from Coal River Mountain Watch says that's nothing to celebrate. Here she is again.
Listen, you know, they're saying coal is West Virginia's economy. It's our prosperity. Well, excuse me, where is the prosperity? We've been mining coal for over 110 years, and we're the poorest state in the nation.
Still, for better or worse, coal has been at the heart of West Virginia's economy for more than a century. And it's still very much at the heart of the U.S. energy mix.
Right. It accounts for more than half the electricity we make in this country.
And that gives you a sense of the scale of change that would have to happen to replace that coal with clean energy. Any way you look at it, this is going to be a long-term process with many bumps along the road. And there's the rub. Klaus Lackner, he's a geophysicist at Columbia University, says even if we mount that World War II effort you mentioned earlier, there's still plenty of coal and oil to tempt us if things get tough.
The giant pool of fossil carbon we still have is 90% or more of what we started with. We have just scratched the surface of that, and this will not end in our lifetimes or our children's lifetimes. So as a result, it sits there and it says we're cheap, we're easy, and just use it up.
Which is why a lot of scientists who at one time wouldn't even discuss the idea of adapting to a changing climate now see it as a necessity. And we'll talk about that tomorrow, including how one major U.S. city is already planning for the worst.
You can hear earlier parts of our series, The Climate Race, on our website. Also, check out a slideshow of that solar thermal facility that Sarah visited. Our homepage is marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which comes with the observation that I have a son who's about the right age for the talk. Not that talk, although, yeah, probably that one too. But I'm talking about the one about staying off drugs. An item on the Wired magazine website caught my eye today. Seems most parents feel more comfortable talking with their kids about drugs than helping them study math and science. That's from a survey done by Intel, by the way, so there may be some ulterior motives. Me, I'm the social studies guy in my house, so I'm going to send this one along to my wife, I think. Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow jumped 199 points. That's 2%. The NASDAQ up 37 points, 1.8%. The S&P 500 up 23 points, 2.25%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time, the climate race continues. How responding to climate change is a lot like your homeowner's policy.
The way I would suggest we need to think about climate change adaptation, it's like insurance. You know, you protect yourself against a certain amount of risk. You accept a certain amount of risk because it would be too expensive to protect yourself against every possible risk.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.